The subject this morning is the reading of a lecture that was given by Swami Ashokananda in August of 1962. And the title of the lecture was Do Not Seek for Him, Just See Him. This is a sentence from a small book called Inspired Talks. The talks were given by Swami Vivekananda in 1895 when he spent about 2 months at Thousand Island Park on the St. Lawrence River in New York State with a group of his disciples. He was very peaceful there, having been relieved of the continuous work that he had been doing in New York City, and his mind soared high. He himself thought it was a period of high spiritual status. He held classes in the mornings, and in the evenings he would just speak freely to the disciples for hours, sometimes deep into the night. One of them, very close to the great Swami, took longhand notes of his talks. The notes were incomplete, only summaries, but the Swami was much impressed and felt that she had recorded his words and ideas correctly. Along with the beautiful account of those days, these notes were published in 1908 from our monastery in Madras and were called Inspired Talks. In this account, there is this beautiful statement, do not seek for him, just see him. This statement of the Swami has always remained in mind, and I find it worthy of deep consideration and meditation. At the very first, you might say, what is the sense of telling us to see God since we cannot see him? It makes sense that we must seek for God. That is what we should be doing. Yes, when a person becomes spiritually inclined and knows how inadequate his knowledge is, he tries to find God, about whom he has heard so much. In all earnestness, he is seeking him, or at least trying to have some evidence from personal experience that this wonderful God indeed exists. There have been various theories about this ultimate destiny of man. And according to these theories, people have their own views as regards God realization. Not many encourage us to think that we can see God in this life. Those believing in reincarnation will tell you that finding God takes many, many lives. Those who believe in the one life theory think that if a person lives on earth in a certain way, then after death he may see God. Buddhists do not believe in any ultimate being to be seen or realized or lived with, but they speak of the conditions of consciousness, of mind, of being, which one must attain. Buddha was very definite about the ideal which he placed before mankind and which he wanted everyone to realize. Agnosticism cannot do that sort of thing. However, you must notice this, that just as in Christianity you are told to take refuge in the Savior, Buddhists took the vow, even in the time of Buddha, to take refuge in the Buddha. And as time went on, Buddhists began to think a great deal about the Buddha. It is true that Christians believe Christ is God, but though theologically that may be true, Psychologically, one is more aware of Christ than of God in Christian practice. In reading the Christian Gospels, one is impressed with the idea that Christ did not as much advance the ideal that everyone must see God as the ideal that everyone must become perfect, endowed with the most wonderful qualities and virtues through their own efforts, or more through the grace of the Savior. As to the ultimate destiny of the soul, Christians would say that in this life you may not see God or have the vision of Christ, but after you die, if you have lived the good life as enunciated and defined by Christ and take refuge in Him, you will go to heaven and live in fellowship with the Lord, seeing Him, feeling His benign presence, and enjoying wonderful peace and blessedness. Well, if I am to speak about faith, and if I have some faith, I will say that faith is always derived from experience. Sometimes, though you may not have had that experience, you are very close to having it. Just as darkness is removed and light spreads over the earth even before the sun has actually risen in the east, in the same way you may be close to that state in which spiritual experiences are at hand, and there comes a great conviction. That conviction also is faith. But when you have actually had some big spiritual experience and your whole being has changed, the very texture of your being has changed, that is the real faith. There is no more possibility of doubt. Otherwise, what is called faith is just belief. Unless you are put to the test, your soul might not know whether you have real faith. In India, we have not emphasized faith much. When theistic denominations do emphasize it, they make up for this emphasis by continually calling upon or speaking of the theme that God has to be actually seen, God has to be actually perceived. And they will tell you that God is not far off. One thing that may puzzle you in India is the familiarity with which people speak of God, as if He is just a person among other persons. Many Hindus have a family chapel where there is daily worship, and they have a firm belief that the Lord is the head of the family. To Him, they bring all their sorrows and difficulties and problems. To Him, they bring all their satisfactions and joys. Everything they place at His feet, and whatever He wills, is all right. When the first flower of the season blooms on a plant, it is gathered and laid on the altar. Similarly, in devout families, no one, not even the little children, eats dinner until the food has been offered in the chapel to the Lord. You may say it is just too human. Well, it is all in the way you look at it. What, on the other hand, is the sense of thinking that God is far, far off? In one breath, you say that He is omnipresent. We live and move and have our being in God. To think anything is outside of God is to limit Him. In the next breath, you say that He is not present on the altar. Was this what Christ taught? Why, many of these theological ideas originated many centuries after Christ was born and lived and died. What was the faith? What was the understanding by which the early Christians lived? Why, in the first centuries after Christ, did so many devote themselves to the utmost austerities? they compare with the very best mystics and saints and ascetics of any religion. Some of them were so very great. Why do you think they lived this kind of life? And why even now do you find many Christians who want what is called a personal religion? Not that they find fault with the doctrine of the churches, but they mean that their religion should not be merely consisting of, I believe this, I believe that. They want to have some spiritual experience in their life. A good many believe in sudden change, after which they call conversion, and that is wonderful. If dependence on this kind of change is the right attitude, why do you think Christ in the Sermon on the Mount and everywhere took such pains to teach people what they should and should not do? Every great teacher has done this, and every religion has taken the view that man is capable of practicing these teachings and that he has to struggle to do so. If you say that man just doesn't have enough power to struggle and to do all those good things unless he has the grace of God, the answer to that is to think that the grace of God is separate from your own existence is wrong. Isn't he the very essence of your being? Can you separate yourself from God? To separate yourself from God, you would have to be outside of God. Then where are you? Is there any reality outside of God? No. He is the soul of your soul. And when we make efforts, do you think his light does not illumine our path? Every effort a person makes is made because this perfect being, this perfect knowledge and perfect light is always in and through and outside of everything. Why should we say that human beings cannot do anything? Well, if they want to make that kind of separation, believe that man has no substance, that is God who has ensouled and substantiated everything, who is the essence of all existence, you may do it. No one can deny that. But when you say, we shall do this, or we shall try to do this, you take it for granted that there is also the presence of the Lord with you always. And if you want to take a more philosophical attitude, you will have to realize that your own self is not such a small thing as you thought in the beginning. The fact is, we are accustomed to seeing and thinking of the outside. Not many of us have learned to go within. A few who have done so dwell on the activities of the mind, which they call thoughts. We must penetrate even the barrier of thought. I call it barrier because it is an opaque thing. Mind, when it is full of thought, is like water churned into foam. We don't see the water, we only see the foam. We have to allow the foam to subside, then we can see what the water looks like. We would not know what the mind is when it is not thinking. Until we have reached the state where the mind is not acting, that is why there is meditation. How, when one has penetrated that barrier of thought for the first time, the majesty of the self bursts upon him. What we are at that time, we begin to suspect. However you look at it, it is foolish to think that we are separate from God. If you do not like the idea that the soul is identical with God, that is all right, but you are not separate from God. You are made after the image of God. The soul is of the same substance as God himself. And you begin to realize it when you have become pure, because then, and only then, you're capable of actually seeing God. Christ said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." You will know what you really are and what real relation you have with God. So I would not say that even now, while we are still struggling, we are completely divorced from God. It is true, his glory is obscured. His light cannot shine through our present state of mind. But a little does percolate. Even when the sky is overcast, the sun is not gone. Enough light penetrates the clouds for a person to work on this earth. In the same way, even when our mind is dark with ignorance, God's light percolates through it, and therefore we try to do good things, to search for him, to make every effort to be close to God and feel his presence. We find that our efforts are blessed with success, otherwise spiritual life would be absolutely meaningless. Why go through all this trouble? Why avoid all the things called wrong or vicious? Why cultivate these virtues? Why try to live so that you can grow in spirituality? Why not just be like a worldly person? No. In every religion, you find you have to live a special kind of life to become spiritual. No one can escape this, no one. A tree is known by its fruit. If you live like a worldly person, such a person you are, in spite of your loud protestation that you are spiritual. Blessed indeed is he in whom has arisen the desire, if not to see God, at least to come close to God, to live a life according to his will. But very unfortunate is he who, having once had this desire in his heart, does nothing about it and foolishly wastes his life. Indeed, and do not think by any sort of little fluke you will enter into the kingdom of heaven. Read all Christ's parables about the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of heaven. The life of a true Christian is very austere, very difficult. But unless you live such a life, how will you become pure enough to see God? If you think of all the prescriptions that have been given by different religions, clearly you can classify them under two headings. There is the prescription expressed in Swami Vivekananda's statement, "Do not seek for him, just see him." And then there is the doctrine of gradualness, which I am describing now. Today you do something, tomorrow you make a little progress, and so on. Hindus will say, struggle on in this life. And as time passes, you will find that you do not want to think of anything but God, that the one strong desire in your life is the quest for God, to have his vision. Afterwards, you may be born under more propitious circumstances and you will struggle further and gain more, and there will be better opportunities. Thus, in several lives, you may become utterly spiritual, and then you will have the vision of God. I'm rather skeptical, however, of that prescription, because it assumes that the mind can be trusted to go according to this program that one has laid out for it. Have you tried to follow a steady routine in your daily life? For example, you say, I shall read Vedanta philosophy every morning from 9 to 10 or 11. Well, how many mornings do you think your mind would settle down to this study? If your mind is so much at your command, then why you will read only 2 hours? You should say, all the days I shall read and absorb myself in this philosophy until I have realized the truth it propounds. Unfortunately, the mind is not really like that. The first day it is very eager to study, next morning it is not at all eager. But you have made a routine and you sit down with the books. Soon you yawn and begin to doze. You wake up, try again, and find that you have forgotten the ideas in the previous sentences. After an hour or two, you think, what's the use of studying like this? By the third day, you say, I think I'll skip studying today. Maybe tomorrow my mind will be fresher. Well, that's the end of the routine. You see, that is the story of the mind. Now you're trying to live a good life, but maybe you are looking this way and that out of the corner of your eye and thinking, oh, look how jolly these people are. I'm living a dry kind of life. Hey, how do you know that in your next life you will continue to seek for God? You see, until we are fully devoted to God, we have all kinds of kinks in our mind. And one thing a devotee has to do is to get rid of these kinks, otherwise no progress is possible. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, now you have the desire to think about God, do it now. What will happen 5 years after, how do you know? And if this life goes, how do you know when you will have such an opportunity again? Don't take things for granted. Maya, the force which keeps us bound down to this life, is strong and makes all kinds of impossible things happen. So he would always advise, do the best you can now while your mind is favorable. Everybody wants pleasure. I don't mean you must have a long face, but if you have to have an objective, it should not be either pleasure or pain, but that by which you find truth, by which you can realize a higher state of being. Have you ever found a person who just by being happy has become greater than he was? No, happiness is the accompaniment of the status you have already realized. Pain comes when you want to reach a higher status, because struggle is involved, self-mortification is involved. One part of your mind you have to control, and another you have to activate. Both controlling and activating are, of course, laborious processes. And so during the period of struggle, life becomes rather dreary, if not also painful. Once Swami Vivekananda wrote to a gentleman who was a devotee as well as a great scholar, and he said, sir, where has any man realized anything great without shedding lots of tears? That is to say, without suffering. You tell me when you have realized anything great just through enjoying. You might think I'm speaking of a rather old-fashioned religion. Well, ask your modern kind if it is religion or not. Just because someone calls it religion, it does not become religion. If you want to commune with God, it is a matter of your own heart and not of obeying this rule or that. Loving God is loving God, and love is not according to any rule. You fall in love with someone and then find a book and say, no, look, look, I have not done this, just wait, I have to go through this step. It is a matter of your own heart. You love someone, your heart likes to dwell upon the object of your love. You want to serve that person, you want to try your very best for them. That is the nature of love. And if we apply it spiritually, it is the same. Only, of course, you have to do a great deal more along these lines than you would have to do for a human love. With utter unselfishness, complete forgetfulness of self, you are full of the spirit of service for your beloved. And your whole heart and soul are gone to them. That is love. If you love God, is there any rule about it? What rule will give you that love? Now, I do not say rules are wrong, but I do say having rules is a lower state. And if somebody says that obeying rules is all I must do, then I shall say, no, no, you are blocking my path. I can see the Lord now. What should prevent me? But of course, many do not say that. As I told you, they think, oh, by and by, I will attain. This life so much, next life so much. And as I was asking, how do you know about the next life? Maybe your mind will have other objectives. And then many lives will go before the desire to think of God comes again into your mind. That is why Hindus continually grumble against being reborn. Don't think just because they believe in reincarnation, they like the idea. There is a hymn which ends by saying, O Lord, save me from the suffering of being born again. You see, there is a strong streak of ignorance in our nature. And this ignorance, or avidya, implies many things. Forgetfulness is one of them. The tendency to go back to our old accustomed state is a strong tendency. As a matter of fact, progress is never in a straight line. It tends to have a circular movement. You start to go ahead, and before you're aware, the line you're following curves a little, and you find yourself coming back to your starting position. If you are clever, you will at once stop short and say, what is happening to me? And instead of running the full circle, you quickly go back to a higher position and continue your effort. Mind will always try to revert to the old position. Remember this, if you're trying to realize a higher state, or if you have realized the higher state and are careless, then there is a very good chance that that mind will come back to its old position. One has to be very alert. Well, no use complaining about it, because mind will behave according to its own nature. Unfortunate it is, but then if you are careful, you will stop that circular process and go ahead. Gradualness, therefore, is a sort of trap for the soul. You don't know what will happen. Beware of those who do say that one should do it gradually, by and by. That's an expression I've heard in this country. When a person becomes too intent upon religion, his friends say, don't go off the deep end. They think it's better to maintain both sides, to be worldly and to be spiritual. And if you can mix, as if you can mix these two. And if you say, I shall take half of light and half of darkness, and thereby I shall become an enlightened person, you cannot do it. The fact is, even when you make wholehearted efforts, you succeed only partly. It goes without saying, the mind is not easy to control. We cannot really control those parts of which we are not aware. It is of the essence of self-control that we should know the whole mind. Otherwise, we would not know what to do with which part. Which tendencies are right and which tendencies are wrong. We cannot know the whole mind at the start. what happens is this, as we go deeper and deeper, we know more and more of our mind. And thereby we find some things in it are good, some are bad, and can act accordingly. And I may tell you, there is a wonderful sense of balance and harmony in the spiritual mind. That is to say, if you are sincerely trying to live the spiritual life and make the right kind of effort, you will make progress. And as you make progress, at each step you will become aware of something more about your mind. And you will also have the ability to take care of the wrong parts. All things go hand in hand if you are practicing the right way. For this you need the help of a spiritual guide. The guide is the one who can tell you your path and how to practice. And you must follow that guidance in every detail. It won't do, for example, to think that you can do more than you have been asked to do. Perhaps you are told to practice only half an hour. You say, what? I'm told to practice only, to meditate only half an hour? Certainly, that is a poor opinion of me. So you start practicing 2 hours a day. A month or two later, you complain that your mind is getting more restless and you cannot sleep well and so on. And of course, you end up by giving up the practice altogether. Sri Ramakrishna used to say that in time you reach a state of spiritual growth where your mind becomes your teacher. You're trying to do something and a strong no will rise from your own mind. It is as if someone actually is telling you, holding you back, and you find if you follow this intuition, you are right. If you disregard it, you come to grief. But that's a very high state of existence, and your mind has become pure, with no selfish desires, no biases and prejudices. And therefore, whatever it thinks is bound to be right. Why should it not think rightly if it has no bias of its own? But until we reach that state of purity, we cannot trust our mind and must follow the guidance of the spiritual teacher. Well, gradualness is one way, but as Swami Vivekananda implied, there is another way by which things can be done. It's an easier way, sort of easier way, and more fruitful. It is based on jnana, or philosophical knowledge. It is not jnana yoga, the path of knowledge. It can be any path, but the basis has to be jnana, or knowledge. The essence of this jnana, this knowledge, is that there is only God, and nothing but God. This knowledge works in different ways. You know, a devotee, when he reaches a culmination of his efforts, realizes just as the jnani, the knower, does, all is God, nothing but God. Everything is God. There is nothing but God. The devotee's heart does not want anything else. Sri Chaitanya, one of our great teachers of devotion in India, was also a Sanskrit scholar, and he composed many Sanskrit verses. Suddenly he would say a few lines, pregnant with meaning, and his disciples wrote these down. One of these verses was, I do not seek wealth, I do not seek people, I do not seek beauty, I do not seek poetry. My prayer to thee is that in every life I can have devotion to thee and nothing else. End of quote of this prayer. This is reasonless devotion, that is to say, love with no selfish motive. People seek God for many things, The devotee says, I do not seek anything but God. I just want to love God. Do you know that state in which the mind does not seek anything else but God? When that state of mind is fully realized, or realized to a great extent, this world seems to disappear. You might say, I can understand that the world will disappear for the jnani, whose whole effort is discrimination between the real and the unreal. But what is the connection between love of God and the disappearance of the world? Well, how do you know that the world exists? You see, this is where the trouble comes. Every religion, many religions teach us that the world is real, we are real, our defects are real, our sins are real, the Lord has to come and save us, and so on. That is where they put the strongest fetters on our feet. How do you know there is a world and that this world is real? Suppose you have lost some of your senses, what would the world be for you at that time? Together, all the senses are contributing to make this world real for you. You may not realize it now, but a state comes in which you see this is all unreal. Well, this is why Swami Vivekananda was so fond of making statements like, do not seek for him, just see him. One day at our main monastery at Belurmath near Calcutta, he was discussing monistic Vedanta with a disciple and quoted from Shankara's Viveka Churamani, Ekam eva dvaya brahma. That is to say, verily, there is only one Brahman, one divinity, one divine existence. God is the only reality. Then to strengthen that idea, it is said, Neha na nasti kinchana. Here there is no manifold, there is no multiplicity at all. God alone exists, there is no multiplicity at all. If you say there are so many things, animate and inanimate, not he whose eyes have become clear, not for that person. He does not see the manifold. When his mind rises higher and higher, he finds form, as it were, melting away. Form is just a sort of covering. You remove the covering and underneath is the reality. You think that this manifold is very profound, very deep. Yes, as long as you live in your present plane, you will find an end to it. It is always capable of further analysis. But go beyond this plane and you will find this one reality is shining everywhere. Only a fool will give intellectual arguments about reality. A person who has an ounce of wisdom would try to experience it, not reason about it with another foolish person. Well, I admit, since we have this brain, it is good to exercise it, to read philosophy and argue with others is not bad. But if you want to actually experience truth, then that's not the path at all. Only when the intellect has quieted down, mind has been silenced, can you hear the voice of silence, the voice of God. A person who has silenced his mind by getting rid of worldly desires and cravings can hear the voice of God and feels his presence. And that is the richest thing that one can have. If you can say, I seek only God, all right, then realize that. Why hang on to this manifoldness? Can you give up this so-called enjoyment? What have you got out of this? Tell me, have you got anything? After some years of seeking enjoyment, you're a derelict, completely perforated, sucked dry. Everything you had within you is spent. That is why death comes like a scavenger when someone has finished with this world. Is that the end and aim of existence? Because we indulge in the senses, our end is like this. So why should we not be able to give up these things? But a little effort is necessary. So mold your life that you will crave only to see God. And let us see how the world will appear to you. The force of the mind that goes to your eyes to look at this and look at that, that force is gone. Your eyes look different when you have no desire to see all the sorts of things, because your mind has gone away from the eyes. Similarly, when you have no desire for objects of the other senses, you will find that your mind has gone from them. Isn't it a fact that if your mind is elsewhere, even if you have good hearing, you will not hear people talking? You will see cooperation between mind and senses and the sense organs. External and internal is necessary, as well as the cooperation of an outside medium before you can have any sense perception. So if your mind is not in the senses, the world would not exist for you. And if your mind has gone to God, how can it be in the senses? It cannot be in both. When your whole mind has gone to the Lord, you can say, I do not want anything from this world. O Lord, I want only you. Sri Ramakrishna demonstrated it. He said, when this state came to me and my heart became eager to find the Divine Mother, actually to see her, I did not see this world. Everything disappeared from my vision as if engulfed by a dense sandstorm. So the philosophical ground for the disappearance of the world is corroborated by his actual experience. If you say, well, great saints also have lived in this world and have talked with people, therefore their mind was in the senses, yes, you're right. Of course, you're wrong also. You see, when the mind has received the vision of God once, then it becomes completely transformed. That mind, even if it comes where the senses are, may have sense perception, but this will never bring the same meaning. If you are an illumined soul and now your mind has come down, you may look at people and talk with them, but no longer will you think them to be just simply people. You will find that they are manifestation of God himself. That happened to Sri Ramakrishna. It took him years and years to bring his mind down to the ordinary plane. Those who went to him told how he would talk a few minutes about God and then plunge into samadhi, into God consciousness. In that state, he would remain sometimes the whole day, sometimes 2 or 3 days and nights together. Before that, he had gone into that state sometimes for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month without coming down. What is that state? It is complete union with God. After great effort, he brought his mind down to the sense plane. And when he felt ecstasy coming upon him, he would often pray to God, the Divine Mother, to stop it. He would say, Mother, Mother, don't make me unconscious. I want to talk with your children. I want to sing your glory. Well, he succeeded sometimes in holding his mind to a lower plane, but this prayer did not always avail. As he was talking about something spiritual, his mind would spread upward. For 5 or 6 years he taught, and that was the intensive period of his life, so far as teaching was concerned. Then he said, how can I teach anymore? I see everyone as God himself. Who will teach whom? Yes, that state comes. He had a hard time teaching anyone. All the great ones have found that a time comes when they cannot teach. After Swami Vivekananda returned to India from the West in 1897, his mind flitted upward and remained perpetually in the superconscious state. It could not come down to a lower state. He wrote of this state in a letter to one of his American disciples when he was in America the second time. He said, now it occurs to me that my mission from the platform is finished. I cannot anymore tell from the platform. The next phase will be the miraculous touch and not the tongue. Like Ramakrishna, he had the ability to give spirituality just by a touch. That's it, the mind gets so high and doesn't come down to this plane. That is the state of jnana, the recognition that everything is really God. It is God whom you are seeing as persons. Isn't it true? What is God? God is everything. Everything is God. If you do not see it, unfortunate you are. Pray to the Lord that the scales may fall from all our eyes. And I shall say further, why have you made any effort to realize God in this way? You know, it is a very simple thing, just a very simple proposition. You say God is infinite, so whatever is must be him. And something to be in him must be of the same nature as he. God is infinite consciousness. And if you say the world is in God, then the world also is consciousness. You will have to say these things to yourself. When you have said all, then you will find the truth is not really very difficult to accept. And how very wonderful it is to live in the world where you are surrounded by the presence of the Lord. Is anything more perfect than the Lord? Do you think that loving him would not come very naturally to you? Is it not true that the Lord is the fulfillment of everything that you have tried to find in this life? So you see, it is not very difficult to learn to realize this truth. And when you realize it, everything becomes simple. There are those who say, oh, it would be very uncomfortable to be surrounded by the Lord. It would be too much for me. Why should you be afraid of this? No. Swami Vivekananda is saying, do not seek for him, just see him. Isn't it a nice saying? It reminds you of the principal fact that that which people in the name of religion seek for and think is very far off, never to be reached by us, is all the time right before our eyes. But you see, we are misreading it, and that's our trouble. You know that a diamond in the rough looks just like an ordinary stone. Its value is not apparent until you have ground and cut it. Then it will shine and you will say, oh, what a wonderful diamond. Our position seems to be the same. We look at God himself, we don't recognize him. We say, this is a person, this is a bird, this is a beast. And we say, this is a good person, this is a bad person, all kinds of stuff we say. So based on this knowledge that everything is God, your effort is just a matter of correcting your attitude. If you look at someone and say, oh, what a hateful person that is, at once you correct yourself. About whom am I saying this? I'm saying hateful. regarding the appearance or action or mental state of that person. But the real person is not this mind or this body. No, he is not. You may tell me, well, that's only a formula. What difference does it make to say that he is not the mind and not the body? My friends, when your mind has become comparatively free of desires and you say this person is not body and mind, you will have a new experience. I say you will have an experience. What you have said is justified, therefore, it is not mere talk or a repetition of a formula.